Welcome to Manager Tools. Today's cast, How to Choose a Managerial Successor, Part 2. The questions this cast answers are, how do I choose a successor? What qualities should I look for in a successor? And can I choose a successor for a subordinate manager? If you'd like answers to these questions and more, keep listening. We're often asked if the CEO or president or other executives should participate in our client trainings. And the answer to that is a resounding yes. And why not? Every executive who sat in our training has shared that the training was beneficial and that they learned behaviors that will prove useful to them in their day-to-day life. And not to mention the fact that it sets a huge example to the rest of your organization that you, Mr. or Mrs. Executive, are professionals just like they are. You're never too old, you're never too seasoned to learn. Send us an email to customerservice@manager-tools.com and learn more about how we can serve your organization. That takes us then to looking for solid communication skills. Now, communication skills are, they're always important for managers, as you obviously know, but they're essential in terms of management. So as it pertains to frontline managers, assessing your potential successors for the toughest promotion in an organizational life cycle ever, from individual contributor to manager, is vitally important.
Yeah, communication skills are a very important assessment criteria as someone's going from individual contributor to manager. Absolutely. There's also, though, there's a parallel between relationship skills and communication skills. And in the same way that we suggested earlier, you likely underestimate how much your communication skills have grown because of the nature of the managerial role, just like you did with your relationship skills. Someone on your team who is a top performer in their specialty has good relationships among your team. And they may not be a solid enough communicator to make the jump to manager.
Yeah, it's a hard jump.
If they're only having to relate to professionals with similar backgrounds to theirs, they can probably do fine within the team.
Yeah.
But communication as a manager, and even more so as a director, requires more flexible, more varied as well, communication skills.
Generally, teams within organizations are made up of people who do similar tasks. Generally, specialization of labor, which means that when your direct moves from individual contributor to manager of those individual contributors, it's likely that they spoke the language, knew the lingo, right? They were one of those, like engineering, right? They went from an individual engineer to a manager of the engineering team. I mean, they know deeply the specialty and how to communicate well with people who share that same specialty. So it's just, it's maybe a less stable indicator of relationship success. Do they get along with people who've done exactly what they've done than it would be from a manager perspective? When you're looking at managers, by nature of management, generally, if you're on a team with other managers, the people on your teams do different things. Like the other managers are managing people who do different things entirely. So there's really no lingo shared amongst that frontline manager. Again, generally. It depends how big your organization is.
You don't get to use the word generally again for the rest of the class.
I know, right? I used it a lot of times. But
you've used it up.
I know.
It's okay.
I've got it in my mind right now because we're working with L3 Harris. We've a client of ours, L3 Harris. Yeah. We work with them often to teach them the effective manager conference, the effective manager content, I suppose. And when we work with them, they have 600 engineering managers.
Yeah.
So they're literally managing teams of people who do the exact same thing. There are literally other people in the team that do the exact same thing, even though they're all managers. So it's really, it depends how big your organization is.
Genuinely, I believe it also depends on if you're in the office and co-located. A lot of times, especially like L3 Harris, big organizations, they put a team close together because, of course, as distance increases, communication decreases. Sure. If you have somebody on your team who's really good at talking to your team, but the team all sits in the similar desk area, and so it's a co-location convenience kind of ability to communicate and not them demonstrating the ability to engage in communication with people who are not co-located, you might find that they're communication is simply by convenience in some cases. I've seen this where there are people and they sit next to a group, they talk to that group all day long, their relationships are strong, they have no relationships with anyone outside of the people who sit near their cubes because it's just convenient. And communication as a manager, and even more so as a director, requires more flexible communication skills. We have said this over and over again, often at our effective communicator conferences. It doesn't matter what your DISC profile is, nearly as much as it matters whether or not you can be flexible with your communication when you're communicating with someone who has a different behavioral tendency than you.
Exactly.
It's not about the profile. It's about willingness to adapt.
Yep.
That's the most important piece. It's not your profile. And I would suggest willingness to adapt is a personality trait rather than a DISC trait. There is no yes. DISC profile that is most likely
adaptable.
To
sure.
Adapt.
Or most willing to adapt. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. There are ones that are more adaptable. There are not ones that indicate more willingness.
Exactly. That's a personal thing. You're absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, that's what we teach at the Effective
yes.
Communicator, right?
You've heard us.
That's what why our MT-DISC, as opposed to other assessments, doesn't speak in length about you and who you are. We're not teaching you more about you. You know yeah. you better than any other person on the planet. What you need to know is how your style can adapt to other people's styles. And in order to do that, it requires you to think really carefully about any potential successor's ability to work with professionals from other different departments, and therefore more likely different communication tendencies. Because what we see is, for example, often people in a technology type organization, IT people generally, share the C profile. Now, whether that's completely C, it's SC, it's DC, they're generally C. Now, if you're envisioning the DISC circle in your mind, what crosses the circle from it is I, completely contrary. Generally, people who are I's within your organization can be found in the sales department and the marketing department and those types of other parts of your organization. Now, what that means is this is exactly why all the IT people think when you have to work with sales and marketing, they are the worst. And the same is true vice versa, right? Sales and marketing, like, oh my gosh, we have to work with somebody in IT. They're the worst. So the individual then that we're choosing, their profile and their adaptability will obviously be shown by relationships in other parts of the organization that are, let's call it, contrary to what their current team does. Somebody in your team who does IT and technology has great relationships with someone in sales, that's an indicator. That means mm-hmm. something.
Yeah. Can your salesperson listen well to a technical expert and stop interrupting after they've asked a question that requires technical content? Can your engineer talk to the salesperson and not talk mm-hmm. only about specs, but also be able to translate what the specs mean in the field to a customer, et cetera? These are the kind of communication skills we're talking about evaluating.
Yeah.
It's really not enough that a successor be good at communicating where they are. We need to ask ourselves, can they communicate well and flexibly across the organization? Can they communicate to those people who are not co-located to them? Can they communicate to those people whose DISC profile is different, discipline is different? Are they able to do so? And are they willing?
Yeah, exactly. And are they willing?
Are they going to approach it with kindness and positive intent and, mm-hmm. and those things?
And all those things. Okay. So we spent a bunch of time telling you essentially that one, your top performer doesn't have to be the person, and two, how to figure out whether or not your top performer is or is not the person. So
yep.
Now let's cover, what about if your top performer wants it but isn't right? Because now you got the tools you need to evaluate whether or not they were right. What if it turns out they're not? What if your top performer wants to get promoted, but in your assessment, they do not have some of the necessary skills to make the jump to your level? In that case, we have a special obligation as managers, congratulations you, to both communicate with them about the skills gap and work with them to help them develop the skills needed to make that move.
It's easy, and we see it happen, that managers make the right choice. They choose their second or third or best performer second or third best performer who also has the skills for the next level, and then they don't take the time to tell the top performer about their skills gap.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't tell their top performer about the gap, it's highly unlikely that they're going to coach or develop the top performer to help them achieve their career goals. And we're going to recommend that you do both, that you talk to your top performer about the gap, that you coach them, develop them. And y'all, we're going to recommend too that you assess this yearly, like think about it, ask yourself, is this still right?
Yeah.
And it might be that your top performer can catch up and bridge that gap and meet those skills. Often top performers, because they know they're awesome, they just want to know how they can be better.
Yeah.
So we recommend that you do not avoid this conversation. It creates a terrible and dangerous retention problem to avoid the conversation and coaching work here.
I would suggest it's as, if not more dangerous than promoting your top performer. And we talked earlier about, right, that skills gap. If you promote them, assume that they're now managing a team that doesn't have them on it. And that is a dangerous results gap that you're leaving for them. And it's the same thing, the same thing here-ish, in that if you avoid having the conversation with your top performer, you don't have the conversation, you haven't done the work to increase their skills, you promote the second or third person in terms of results to being their manager, what if the top performer leaves? Now that second or third person who was the right person, let me be clear, they were the right person to choose because they're the only ones that had the skills. Now they also don't have the top performer. So you're not in any better position.
Yeah.
You're truly not. We still have a team missing its top performer.
Yeah. And again, results are the ultimate scorecard. Mm-hmm. So we're obligated to work with a top performer who doesn't have the relationship or communication skills, much more so than we're obligated to work with someone who is a weak performer, but perhaps has the communication and relationship skills. In the case of a weak performer, we would insist that their performance improve and coach them on how to do so before we considered coaching them in other areas to help them become a successor.
That's exactly it.
So we focus on results, and in that focus, we derive other behaviors that would create success for the team and success for those people whose skills are not maybe necessary for the next role in which they need to engage.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. I think it's, I mean, we have so many podcasts on coaching. Coaching Dilemma is the one that's coming to my mind right now. But in terms of coaching, when we say to people, who should you spend your time coaching first? Immediately, it's take the lower performer and increase their results. I'm not going to say never because that's untrue. Rarely have I heard a manager or anybody, frankly, say, I need to coach my top performer to be better at relationships. It's just not the thing that comes to your mind. It's really not. And again, to your point, Kate, we have the obligation to help these people improve those skills so that they potentially will be ready to be our successor, let's hope one day, or that they at least know that they have this gap that they can work on or whatever it may be. I mean, frankly, they've done all this work for us. Why wouldn't we just invest a little bit more and help them get there?
Southern Hemisphere, we have a training just for you. Starting April 2nd, we're running an 8 p.m. Eastern, which is midday in Australia, event. 4 modules on one-on-ones, feedback, coaching, and delegation. Learn what they don't teach you about how to be a manager. A virtual effective manager conference, April 2nd start date, 8 p.m. Eastern start time. Sign up at manager-tools.com/training.
Now, it's not just about choosing a successor, though, of course. You have to notify other, more and more communication. You have to notify your boss and others of the choice. Naming successor is not a private decision, even though we know you've probably have never been asked about your successor or your number two. Again, no one's holding you accountable. That really only proves that managers at all levels don't know how organizations are meant to operate. And your lack of knowledge in this case, I'm so sorry, I don't mean to say it like this, isn't respective of the fact that this isn't true. It just means, yet again, we're discovering things that managers weren't told and don't know they were supposed to do. By definition, executives are responsible for the long-term health of the organization. And that means knowing who is ready now and who will be ready next. We've got a podcast, Ready Now, Ready Next. This is one of the reasons why companies who will have always promoted only from within typical, or only from within, sorry, typically outperform those firms who hire at all levels. It's debilitating to the career desires of employees to see their organization hiring managers and executives from outside, knowing, and I mean, we can assume, going back to previous, there's the desire to move up in the organization, at least by some people, at least at some levels. So there are definitely people with the desire. And if you as a manager don't get them ready for that next level, and then when you need someone at that next level, you see, oh my gosh, I haven't done my job. I really haven't gotten ready, people ready. Well, I guess what I need to do is hire at this higher level. It's debilitating to your organization. People feel discouraged. Why work here? There's no upward mobility. They say it exists, but I've never seen it.
Mm-hmm. You're not only obligated to have a successor, but to notify your boss and your team of who that person is. We have to notify our boss so that she knows that when she sees our successor, she is seeing us. Our boss has to know that when our successor speaks, he speaks for us. If your boss doesn't know that, they would be justified in asking all kinds of questions of our direct, air quotes. Have you talked to your boss about this? Why are you here and not your boss? Why is your boss not here? And yes, of course, it's possible that you'll name a successor and you'll communicate that, and your boss will still ask these questions even after they've been briefed. We cannot control our boss's behavior. We can only prepare them to behave appropriately. So we're going to create what is true, internal talent markets being less inundated by friction through communication, and facilitate that internal mobility.
That's exactly it. And
not
one of the ways that we're gonna, one of the ways we're going to get folks ready for that, because I mean, your boss would really have no reason to say, why are you here? Why is your boss not here? If your director weren't going to your boss about stuff, therefore you need to create more opportunities for that to occur by delegating projects and presentations. And in the earlier part of this guidance, Kate talked quite a bit about delegation and its importance. And in our quick and dirty guidance about choosing a number two, we made the point that delegation played a huge role in choosing a successor. A successor isn't just someone who fills in for you. They're also someone who is in training to become you. Doesn't matter whether they ever become you or not, in terms of taking your role when you get promoted or when you leave, whatever the opening of your role means for you. So it doesn't matter whether they become you or not. What matters is that if they are named your successor, that comes with the understanding that you're preparing them as fully as you possibly can to take over your responsibilities and managerial role.
Many people who have been listening for a while might remember our Hall of Fame guidance about the juggling koan. We make the case that when your boss delegates a new big ball or big project, big task to you to juggle, what they actually delegated was a small ball for them. And as it moves down, it becomes a bigger ask of you, a big ball for you. Mm-hmm. If you're not familiar with the analogy, you can think of your job as a box of balls that you juggle. Some are big, some are small. Size represents importance and also the amount of time you spend on them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the reason for this is responsibilities. When they're delegated downward, they get bigger because the person accepting the delegation has never done the task before. Therefore, it takes more time and is, let's call it, more important. And therefore, in the analogy, larger. While in terms of the person delegating that task, someone who's done it for quite some time and is quite competent at the task, for them, the ball that they delegated was relatively small by comparison,
because
they'd done it repeatedly. So they had the time to take what was a big ball for them initially, anyway, and through the course of practice, make it smaller. But when they pass it down, it becomes a large ball to the person they've given it to.
Yeah, it's the learning curve. And we can use that analogy to think about what happens to someone who gets promoted who has never been delegated to.
Yeah.
They've never handled any responsibilities that their boss had. And now all of those responsibilities are theirs.
Yeah.
And therefore, they all are big. So every single thing has a learning curve. Every single thing is huge.
like overwhelmingly huge.
Yes, especially all at once. If you don't delegate to your named successor, when they do take over your role or one of your peers' roles, they will be completely unequipped to handle their new job and they will be the one punished, but it'll be your fault.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a perfect example of moral hazard. And the solution is delegation. Simple.
That's exactly it. That is exactly it. You have to get them equipped for it. You can't say you're my number two and then not let them do the things that they will need to do if they become number two. So what you need to do is delegate to a successor things that you might not delegate to just anybody on the team, but because they're your successor, you need to delegate these things for their development. And our experience shows that the two most effective successor development delegations are presentations and projects.
Right. Presentations are effective because they expose your successor to more senior people in a mode allowing significant preparation and therefore a greater chance for successful impressions more often. Mm-hmm. Most managers want for themselves the platform that a presentation to senior people gives. So they hoard them and deny directs the opportunity to get exposure, to learn, to stretch themselves. Mm-hmm. And okay, yeah, there's risk, y'all. We get it. You're scared. Your successor might mess it up. But your job in developing your team is not the avoidance of risk.
Yeah.
Common wisdom today about employees needing safe spaces and decrying anything that makes them uncomfortable is an anathema to development and growth. Mm-hmm. To help someone grow, we must intentionally put them in situations that are uncomfortable, that are stretchy, that make them feel risk and fear and uncertainty. Mm-hmm. It's true, and it's a bummer.
Ask yourself, how often am I just comfortable? Just like super comfortable. Like there's no risk here. I feel like super happy and super safe. Almost never.
Oh,
if you feel
seriously, hours a week.
Hours a week. That's exactly it. So why on earth would we expect that our directs could be kept in this safe bubble and they would still be able to grow at the pace and rate that we're growing? Of course they can. Your organization isn't in this form of stasis either. The organization as a whole is in this, I'm going to call it state of uncomfortable, in that it takes risks all the time with new products. And it's never certain whether or not those things are going to be successful. Any company that did only things that were comfortable would fail in minutes. As Warren Buffett said hundreds of times, the primary cause of the death of corporations is complacency.
Yeah.
Comfort equals death in the organizational sense. It really does. So why? Why keep your folks comfortable? And I know it feels like a gift. I really do. I talk to managers all the time. I know you're doing it from like this warm, soft spot in your heart. And you're just like, but I care about them and they're so overwhelmed. But folks, the gift you're giving them is rotten.
Yeah, it looks pretty.
It looks pretty and you think it's out of the best place ever, but what you're doing is creating a world where if they get promoted to do your role at some point, I mean, they succeed you, they will be fully ill-equipped and they will fail. And that's not a good place.
That being said, with presentations, you have iterative ways to develop their skills. You can reduce the risk, gradually taking them through the process. First, you delegate the creation. Then you delegate the creation of several. Then you delegate the creation and presentation. You take time. You do this iteratively. They attend two or three of your presentations so they can see it. Then the delegation includes the creation. And then it's the rehearsal. And then it's the actual giving of a presentation that you would give. Mm-hmm. Help them rehearse. They present to you. You have time. There's feedback opportunities. This is as iterative as it can be.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. Presentations are great for that.
They are. And they can be broken into smaller pieces.
Yeah.
With projects, we've got an excellent delegation opportunity because projects teach the art of getting things done through relationship power. Because project managers don't have role power authority. So we're exposing our successor to other departments often because they have to work with other people to get these projects done. Compromises learned, communication skills are increased. They develop new relationships, which they'll likely need if they're going to take over for you after you get promoted for being such an awesome developer of team members.
Of course.
And projects are also filled with opportunities for you to check on progress, give plenty of feedback and guidance, require them to report passively and actively, have a weekly drumbeat meeting, have a task tracker and break all the tasks into very granular items, and then look at it every day and watch for it.
Yeah.
If it's a small project, you may be able to fit all of this into your one-on-one, but if not, you might need your own drumbeat meeting, and we would require the use of online reporting tools after they've created deliverables and deadlines and assignments. This is a super granular list of online reporting of who does what by when, and some of the who is them, and some of it can be you if you're very afraid, although I would suggest giving them part of it won't give them the experience they need to do it when it's their turn fully. Yeah. And the tasking can have reporting. It can have check-ins. You are going to be able to see what's going on.
Yeah.
You can watch. You're there to provide coverage. It's a growth experience.
It totally is. Please don't. I talk to managers all the time. Obviously, I don't affect manager conferences. But please don't delegate something and walk away.
No.
Your role isn't just to delegate stuff in the context of getting stuff off your plate. Your role is to, in this case, your successor, enable them to do this successfully. But what that means is, because you've been doing it, I mean, again, to you, back to Kate's earlier analogy, juggling koan, it's a small ball to you and it's a big ball to them. You have to help them with it at the beginning. And at some point, gradually through the course of time, they're going to take it on themselves and you'll have very little oversight. And that will be wonderful. But in the short term, you do need these reporting, the reporting functions, I'm going to say, that are inherent in projects generally, so that you can keep eyes on it and make sure things are on track and see if there are any areas of issue or concern that you may need to get involved in, because you may need to get involved, and that's okay too. So that takes us to the last bit of our guidance, and it is recommend humility. Now, it's a small thing, but it is worth mentioning. Instruct your named successor that they are not to mention that they are your successor or number two. Now, what this means is you'll have to have told them, but not the other people in the team, and tell them. It's not an official role. It's a developmental challenge. Mentioning the role would be like, essentially, them mentioning the role, I should say, to their peers, would be like putting MBA in your signature block. It is not a job title. It is right. Really not. You're just bragging now.
And if they're asked why they're in a meeting or doing something that would normally be done by you, tell them to just say, my boss asked me to sit in. She has a conflict. She apologizes. Or my boss is on vacation and I'm here representing him. Short, simple. Anybody who scoffs or complains is silly. So your successor should mention these things to you so that you know the political implications and maybe the people who are scoffing.
That's the thing. I was going to say, so you know who the people that were scoffing were? For example, if it is your boss or your boss's boss, would be worth knowing, right?
Yeah.
Because, of course, you've told your boss, a la our previous guidance a few paragraphs ago, I'm going to say. But if it's your boss's boss, you may want to, be aware of that. And in terms of the things you will delegate to this individual, you have to choose carefully. The meetings that you delegate your attendance to, you have to be reasonably sure that there won't be compensation discussions or other confidential topics. Now, we do hope that the agenda was circulated in advance, but I cannot make that assumption for you, unfortunately. So you're going to have to make an educated guess about what might be discussed in this forum so you can determine whether or not sending them would be the right choice in this case. And since you've let your boss know, they should be able to help your successor navigate any weird moments that come up because you didn't realize what people were talking about today and oops, but your boss knows. So your boss can navigate that for you.
And a bonus, when you choose a successor, include their naming of being the successor in their annual review.
Yeah.
It's a line in their annual review. Almost no one does this, but it's a competitive advantage when reviews are studied. This is because you should be the one touting your successor, not them,
mm-hmm.
right? They don't get to put it in their signature block, like
right?
MBA.
Exactly.
You get to put it there and be the person who highlights it. And it's worth mentioning.
It absolutely is. And I mean, if you've paid any attention to our previous performance review guidance, you'll know that the original purpose of performance reviews was to communicate readiness to the organization. you gotta communicate readiness to the organization. Because your organization may be looking at that and they wanna know who that successor is.
This is the line for that.
This is that line, exactly. So, to wrap it all up, choosing successor is every manager's responsibility. And it's a great development tool that will sharpen your estimating of other people's potential, which becomes a greater part of your job the higher up you move in the organization. As you become an executive, it'll be more important than if you are a manager to choose the right successor. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much for joining us for this cast, folks. Join us again next week for a brand new topic.